Okay, welcome back again. Are you ready for more here? Yeah, okay, good. You have good stamina, that's great. It's a lot of material, a lot of things going on, so just, do what you enjoy here. I hope it's not too much, so we'll just, I'll just keep going, sometimes I see myself as like a Dhamma machine, you just kind of go with Dhamma, 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 and you kind of... So it's kind of nice to be machine, because machine implies non-self, right? It has a kind of right kind of leaning towards things. So. Anyway, so let's come back to the ideas. We're looking at the morality side of the Noble Eightfold Path. And we have looked at a bit at the idea of right action in terms of not killing anyone and having compassion and these kind of things. And we had a look at the not stealing. And I was talking a bit about generosity when we broke, and so you get some ideas there about how generosity works. The idea of being kind of feeling, feeling compassion, feeling an inclination to give, and these things are very important for the generosity to be powerful. That does not mean that you should not give if you don't feel powerfully driven to do it. Generosity is always a positive thing, and sometimes you need to teach yourself these kind of things. So generosity obviously goes against our tendency to be selfish and greedy and hold on to things. Some of the interesting things on the Buddhist path is that to be able to enter a deep state of samadhi, for instance, you have to be perfectly generous. This kind of feeling of just wanting to give to everyone in the whole world. They're just really giving out. So in other words, this when we do practice generosity, we are in a sense leaning the mind towards those kind of qualities that are necessary for entering deep samadhi. Yeah, you have to have this heart where you just want to give to everyone and really just kind of share out everything pretty much. It's fascinating. There is a particular rule for the monks that if someone is too generous, if they kind of give out too much, then you can classify them according to a particular, a particular thing that we do in the Sangha. Classify them as basically being too generous, and then you kind of not supposed to receive food from them because they give too much. Yeah, so sometimes people get too inspired and actually give too much, so they go hungry and they starve. And so it's important to find a balance, of course. But the idea of kind of having this open heart and wanting to share with the whole world is a very beautiful idea. And if you have it, sometimes you can maybe feel some of those feelings, you just want to share with everyone. And you know instantly this is a spiritual quality. There's something very wholesome and very positive about it, very inclusive about it. It's like you bringing the whole world into purview, so to speak, and you everyone is kind of comes into your field of awareness, and this kind of willingness, desire to share with everyone is a very powerful, beautiful quality here. So please develop that as part of the idea of not stealing here, because it is an important part of this path. Let's go on to the next one, which says here, they give up unchastity. They are celibate, set apart, avoiding the common practice of sex. Unchastity is not the ideal translation, because the Pali word is brahmacharya, and brahmacharya means to give up all sexual conduct of all kinds. You're basically abandoning all sexual conduct, you're setting apart, avoiding all kinds of sexuality, essentially. And that is kind of easy to understand. This is obviously the practice for a monastic. For lay people, it's a bit more less demanding. It's just that you don't do anything which is harmful to others in that kind of realm. So that's fairly straightforward. Yeah. So this is one of those things about the five precepts we have. It's called Kamesu Micharchara, not having wrong practice in terms of or in the area of sensuality and sexuality specifically. So it's not very specified. So there you have to kind of figure out yourself when it is harmful and when it is not. Some things are very obviously harmful, but sometimes it's a bit of a grey area. And so you have to be careful, especially these days with the whole Me Too movement, all that kind of things. It kind of has opened up new areas of harmfulness that, 20 years ago wasn't even maybe even thought of as harmful in the same way. So it's always important to be kind of a bit be thoughtful about these things. Yeah, especially if you want to live a very pure life, you want to get these things right. So what is the opposite of sexuality? Well, sexuality is like an umbrella term here for the indulgence in the five senses, right? Because sexuality kind of stands out as often the most powerful of these indulgences, and it often is very much to do with craving and strong desires and these things. It is the most problematic part. So what is the opposite of this? The opposite of this, if we're looking at the negative and the positive side of all of these things, the opposite is meditation practice. Yeah, meditation practice when the mind becomes peaceful, when you abandon all these cravings and desires, you're seeking peace instead. So to be able to do that, at least temporarily, that's why we practice things like celibacy on meditation retreats. Because if you really want to have success in deep meditation, you have to give up that whole area of life, at least temporarily. Because it is the opposite of meditation. Meditation is about peace of mind, quiet, tranquility. Sexuality is about craving, desire. It's the restlessness of the mind, the agitation of the mind. You can't have both at the same time. Sometimes you have to make choices. And it's one of those things which is kind of interesting in parts of Western Buddhism, where people say that, we want to have both. We want to have our fun in ordinary life, and we also want to have meditation practice. And you can take that only so far. There comes a certain point when you have to give up certain things to get something higher. This is what this path is all about. You have to give up things that are restless, full of desire and craving, to achieve something that is really fundamentally peaceful and fundamentally far more satisfying than these other things. This is hard to see for most people. It is very difficult to see. Sometimes you have to have a degree of confidence in this teaching to even think this is true. You can get an inkling of what it means just by enjoying a peaceful meditation. You can get some idea why craving is really problematic. All right, next one here. So now that is the actions, right action. Now we come to right speech. So you give up lying, you speak the truth and you stick to the truth, you're honest and trustworthy, and you don't trick the world with your words. So that is what lying means. Lying means tricking the world with your words. Taking the world with your words. This is an important point, that when you lie, you're trying to deceive. Lying is trying to deceive, right? You're trying to get something out of a situation which isn't true. Your parents catch you red-handed when you're a child taking something, and you kind of just lie through your teeth because you don't want to admit to what's going on. It's kind of sweet when a child does that, but it is not so sweet when you do that later on in your life. So that is an important point, because sometimes people take these precepts too far. And they think, I can't joke, because joke is not the truth. So I can't have fun. And you can make your life very miserable if you take these precepts in the wrong way. The point here is to kind of deceive people. That is bad, right? Because you want something out of it. You don't want to confess to your bad habits, or you've done something bad or whatever, and then you deceive the world. But when you make a joke, you're not trying to deceive anyone. You're trying to make people smile and have a good time. That's a big difference. What is your motivation? What is driving it? That is what matters in these particular cases. So it's important not to get these things wrong. I was just having a chat with one of the office workers yesterday, and she was telling me about, we had a very short chat, but I'm not sure how we got there, but she was saying, I have this friend who's being too serious about this precept. And so remember what it is really about, and then you will get it right. But again, here, the positive side of not lying is to be honest, straightforward. People, you don't kind of try to kind of, you're not like a lawyer, who says, okay, lying, the boundaries for lying are here. And if I just got one fraction of an inch, not a millimeter, fraction of an inch across that boundary, I will be fine. But I won't really be telling the whole truth, but I will kind of be able to maybe slightly deceive without breaking this precept, right? This is the wrong way of thinking about it. It's not about being like lawyers, where we kind of find the exact limits for what is allowable or not. That's dodgy. Lawyers don't have a good reputation in this world. Sometimes, anyway. Maybe some of them have a good reputation. But the idea here is to be as trustworthy as possible, where people feel they can trust you. They feel that in your company, they will hear the truth. Yeah. You're not trying to somehow, you know, deceive them or slightly, you know, slightly kind of embellish reality or anything like that. But don't lose your sense of humor, please. Otherwise, we're going to be a miserable bunch of Buddhists, and that's no good. So, speaking the truth, is it ever right to lie? Now, remember that, as I said before, the final way of deciding whether something is moral in Buddhism is why we are doing things. What is the motivation behind our action? Is it possible to lie out of compassion? Maybe, sometimes it is. The story that Ajahn Brahm tells me was a story of a lady whose husband was going to have a bypass operation, triple bypass, some kind of major operation. And it is known that a certain percentage, they don't make it through those operations. I don't know, 3% die or something like that. And it's good to be in a good state of mind. Yeah, you go into the operation, you don't want to be anxious and too, because then things may go wrong, as they often do. And so in the hospital, he was sharing the room with some other man. And one day, this other man, he was sharing the room, he went into the operation table, and he didn't come back again. And then when his wife came to visit, he asked her, well, what happened to my friend over here? He never came back from the operation table. And she realized that he was one of those few ones who had died on the operation table, having the same operation that he was going to have. And so she thought for a minute, is now the right time to tell the truth? Or is now the right time not to tell, maybe to kind of be a bit, find the right balance in my precepts here? So she told him, I think she lied. She basically said, no, she's fine, don't worry about him. And maybe he is fine, maybe he's had a good rebirth, right? So maybe it wasn't a lie, yeah? You got to see the bigger picture here. So she lied, basically. And I think in a situation like that, when you see that the stress or whatever you're basically coming from compassion, you're trying to deceive the person, but in a positive kind of way. In that situation, is it bad to lie? Maybe not ideal, but is it bad? It's, remember that things are not always good or bad. Sometimes, very often, they're somewhere in between. And this is kind of one of those in-between cases. It may not be the highest kind of purity, but it certainly isn't very bad either. Maybe it is even a good thing to do, actually, in that case. So, was that here yesterday? We had the question about the kamma, black, white. I forget, again, given so many talks the last 4 weeks, I've been wandering around the US giving talks everywhere, I forget where I've said what. Okay, good. So you already have an idea about the different kinds of kamma, black and white, with black and white results. I get a bit blurry. I hope please forgive me my blurriness. So that is the lying. So there's four kinds of bad speech. The second one is about divisive speech. So they give up divisive speech. They don't repeat in one place what they heard in another, so as to divide people against each other. Instead, they reconcile those who are divided, supporting unity. Delighting in harmony, loving harmony, speaking words that promote harmony. And this is such a beautiful thing. The idea of creating harmony and unity in our society. There is so much division these days. People having different opinions, taking these opinions far too seriously and being willing to argue and kind of making enemies of other people because of some silly opinions that may not be all that important anyway, and then creating divisions in the world. So sometimes you just need to understand each other, that in the end we're all human beings, we all suffer, we all have very, very similar problems, we all want to be happy, we all want to live life well. When I look at the Buddhist world, I see Buddhist people of all kinds of political persuasions, and they're all welcome as long as they're good people. They're all welcome to anything that any kind of Buddhist event, and at least where I take part in that event. And so we need to kind of understand our common humanity across all our divisions. And when we do that, we can start to have harmony. We can start to give each other a hug and to say something soothing, to understand that other people, maybe they look at the world differently, but it's only because they have a different conditioning in their life. It's not because they are evil, they are bad, but their conditioning is different. And when your conditioning is different, you are going to see things differently. And once you get that, it's easy, not easy perhaps, but then you can forgive and you can let go and you can shrug your shoulders and say, it's okay, it doesn't matter. And this is a very important thing in the, you know, in at any time really, but especially when the world is very divided and we're heading in different directions so easily. So remember this idea of conditioning. It's a very, very powerful thing, because it can feel like we are so far apart, when actually it is just the slightly different conditioning. We could be in their place, they can be in our place. So remember that. Remember when you see someone who's very different from you, that could be you. Maybe it has been you in the past life. Maybe it will be you later on in this life. Someone you really disagree with vehemently with, and you realize that actually that could be me. And once you get that, once you see yourself in the other person, it changes things dramatically. And then you can have a sense of peace. You can have a sense of compassion and understanding with the most difficult people in this world. So this idea of creating harmony, and it's very important on when we are on a retreat together. You don't look like a very kind of quarrelsome bunch. You haven't been arguing too hard with each other. Right? So that's good. It's very important that we have that sense of harmony in a group like this. And I always like to remind people that in a group like this, good people are coming together, So remember that. And I'm sure if we started talking politics, we'd have disagreements in this group very quickly, because guaranteed there are disagreements in politics. But leave that aside and just focus on the fact that everyone who is here is a good person. That no one comes to these things unless they are good people. And just that idea that all of these people, everyone here, every one of you, me too, by the way, is good intentioned, right? We're all good intentioned people. And just remembering that, you can put all this kind of small stuff, the ridiculous stupidity about ordinary life, that kind of falls by the wayside when you remember the big picture is so positive. This is how you overcome these silliness in life. And on retreats, it's very important, because if there's no harmony on a retreat like this, it destroys the whole atmosphere, and then it falls apart very quickly. Your meditation's not going to work. You don't find any peace, don't find any happiness. You don't find anything worthwhile. So harmony is very important, and you can see here that it is the second kind of a good speech, or the second kind of wrong speech. So it means that the worst kind of wrong speech is lying. Second kind of wrong speech, second most important bad one, is divisive speech. Everything is kind of structured. The third one is harsh speech, right? So you give up harsh speech. You speak in a way that is mellow, pleasing to the ear, lovely, going to the heart, polite, likable, and agreeable to the people. There you are. Speech that is gentle, kind. We know when we hear speech that is nice. When speech is kind of goes to the heart, it's kind of obvious. But I like these little things here. They're kind of really... really nice, They are simple things, but they are nice. And we know them when we hear them. People who produce harmony, people who speak in a gentle way. We know these things. We know how agreeable it is when these things happen. And there probably isn't enough of it in the world, so at least we can make a little bit of difference by getting this right. Then we have the last one, the talk up giving nonsense, not idle chatter, I would say. To give up idle chatter. The words are timely, true, meaningful, in line with the teaching and the training. They say things at the right time that are valuable, reasonable, succinct, and beneficial. So this is about limiting speech, not talking about all kinds of stuff. Sometimes we talk too much. And when you talk too much, things come out of your mouth that probably shouldn't be released from your mouth. This is what happens when you talk too much. Thank you so much for all of these cough lollies. That's wonderful. So, so the idea here is that talking too much, it often just agitates the mind, makes the mind restless, you know, and then you think about these things afterwards and they kind of roam around your mind. And this is one of the reasons why on retreats we often have the idea of noble silence. He had the idea of not talking, but here we talk a little bit because we have Q&A in the evening, but the idea of just when the mouth is quiet, the mind also tends to quiet down as a result of that. But if you have like verbal diarrhea, kind of talking, then usually it's mental diarrhea as well. So it kind of comes from, it originates in the mind. So talk about meaningful things. And it's very beautiful. You know, one of the things about reading the suttas or hearing some kind of great meditator or wise person talk, and sometimes you pick up these gems that are being spoken. And you pick it up and think, wow, that is really nice. And you pick it up. There's something about people who don't say much, but when they open their mouth, you read it, wow, let's hear what they have to say. Because actually they have something interesting to say. Most people, we kind of block them out, because actually they don't have anything, not that interesting anyway. But some people, they have interesting things to say, and you actually listen when they speak. And so let's try to be those kind of people, where when we open our mouths, people actually want to listen to us. It's actually interesting what we have to say here. And that's very valuable to be that kind of person. And when everyone is shouting and there's kind of a lot of people talking together, that kind of person, they often just remain quiet, because it's not about being the loudest and kind of gaining the most, airtime or anything like that. That's not really what it is about. It is about actually being able to say something useful at the right time. So you talk about the Dhamma, you talk about the training, what to do, it could end up being an incredible bore, of course, if you talk only about these things, but what's valuable, reasonable, brief, and beneficial. So I'm going through this a little bit fast, because I've taught these things so many times, So that is the main aspects of morality by body and speech. And this is as true for lay people as it is for monastics. A little bit of a monastic leaning here, but basically true for everyone. So now I'm going to go on to another part here, which is more kind of monastic leaning. But it may still be interesting for you just to hear what it is about. And these are also things that if you go on a retreat where you keep the 8 precepts, here it's only the 5, is it 5 precepts here? Is that how it works? Yeah, 5? Okay, the 8, this is some of these things you will be keeping as well if you keep the 8 precepts. So let's go through this fairly quickly. So the first one here is about they avoid injuring plants and seeds. They eat in one part of the day, abstaining from eating at night and at the wrong time. They avoid dancing, singing, music, and seeing shows. They avoid beautifying and adorning themselves with garlands, pure perfumes, and makeup. They avoid high and luxurious beds. They avoid receiving gold and money, raw grains, raw meat, women and girls, male and female slaves, goats and sheep, chickens and pigs, elephants, cows, horses and mares, and fields and land. Let me stop there, because that's the most important part. The last part is come back to the last one. So let's stop there. So you avoid injuring plants and seeds. Now, why? Are they sentient? Is that the reason why? And this is one of those kind of strange things, because there's nothing in Buddhism really that says that plants are sentient, or if they are sentient, it is not sufficient to be considered immoral to it is not enough to be considered immoral to injure them, right? So this seems to have been a rule that existed at the time of the Buddha, that if you were an ascetic, if you were a monastic, regardless of the religion you belonged to, you didn't injure plants and seeds. That's why it became a rule for Buddhist monastics as well. So is it bad to kill a tree? It is not entirely clear whether aren't plants conscious? What do you think? Yeah.
Well, again, it depends on intent. Why are you doing it, right? I mean, it depends on intention.
Yeah.
There's got to be a reason to do it, right?
Sure, but if I think, sure, but I mean, if a tree is in the way, yeah, this tree is in the way. Yeah, okay, so then it matters whether it's conscious or not, right? Yeah. So. Yes. Anyway, we have a Q&A just in a second. We can come back to this, but it is interesting that if you look at some of the modern science into plants, seems to be more and more evidence that plants may have some rudimentary kind of consciousness. Right? There seems to be some evidence at least pointing in that direction. I don't know exactly what to make of it yet. Maybe it isn't conclusive, but it's kind of fascinating. So maybe, maybe there is. A reason, at least, not to exaggerate, overdo the killing of plants, which probably is good for the environment anyway. Yeah, not to chop down all the trees, etc. It's probably good idea regardless. So anyway, I'll leave that with you. It's not entirely clear why that is there, but I think it's mostly because of the tradition in ancient India. You eat in only one part of the day, abstaining from eating at night and at the wrong time. So Buddhist monastics eat between dawn and midday. And that's what I do here. That's why you don't see me for dinner, because we don't eat at that time. Often we eat only one meal a day. That's what I do here. I only have my lunch. That's great. You'd be surprised how nice it is only to have one meal a day once you get used to it. You avoid dancing, singing, music, and seeing shows, basically avoiding entertainment. That is what this is about. And again, the idea here is to withdraw from the pleasure of the sensory world and then kind of go into the pleasure of the mind. So this is what you do when you go on meditation retreats, right? To withdraw some of that interest from the sensory world. This is what this is about. To avoid beautifying and adorning self with garlands, perfumes, and makeup, not to be too concerned about what you look like. And that is also quite nice to go on a retreat. Very often we are so conscious about what we look like, and of course that leads to a lot of the idea of be concerned about yourself. It has an ego aspect to it, right? A sense of self aspect to it. But when you don't worry so much about what you look like, it takes away some of the focus on yourself as a person, and you become less self-conscious, I suppose, in a kind of setting with many people around you. And when you are on the retreat, it's nice not to be self-conscious. Yeah, you're just one person among many. You just close your eyes. Nobody notices you. You don't notice anyone. Everyone looks a bit like a sack of potatoes. We wear kind of clothes a bit like this, right? There's some kind of white garments, and maybe, I don't know if you shave your head when you go on retreat, but you could do that. And we look kind of plain, and sometimes it's nice to be plain, right? Not being concerned about how other people see us. So that is nice. Takes the sense of self down a bit. You avoid the high and luxurious beds. Okay, so the idea here is really to sleep the right amount, not too much, not too little. So you have a comfortable bed, but not luxurious. You avoid receiving gold and money. And so a monastic should not have any money, ideally. Lots of monastics have that, but this is kind of one of the rules that is broken the most often among monastics. But if you really practice fully as a monastic, you shouldn't have any money. And I have to say that this is one of the greatest liberations I've ever felt, not having to do with money. It's just so nice. And I mean, you can say that I'm privileged because people look after me, right? That is, I have to admit, that's a great privilege. But I never really do anything unless I'm invited to places. Yeah. So in a sense, of course, if you are invited, then of course the host has to look after you. But I don't travel. I don't ask for people to look after me. I don't ask for money. And it's actually incredibly liberating and freeing not to have to think about those things. And you just go, and whatever food is available, well, you eat that and you're content with that. And that's, I don't know, I can really recommend it. There are many good reasons to be a monastic. This is one of them. One of many, many, many. Yeah. Okay. Then you avoid receiving raw grain, raw meat. Yeah, you're not supposed to cook. That's why you don't receive raw things. You don't receive women and girls. Yes, for obvious reasons. you don't receive male and female bond servants. like slaves. You don't receive, and he has this whole list of animals, right? And ending up with fields and land. And this is kind of how wealth was regarded in ancient India. Yeah, your wealth was counted in the number of cows you had, a number of how much land you have. These days, land is still, right, an indication of wealth. Someone who has a large property, they're considered wealthy. So monastics don't have these things, yeah? Everything is abandoned, anything that kind of, first of all, you abandon it when you become a monk or a nun, and then you don't pick it up later on, which is what this is about. Then you don't run errands and messages, and this is the idea that you don't do things, you don't make money, and then it has this list at the end, which is very obvious, which I don't think really belongs there. Anyway, it says buying, selling, falsifying weights, metals and measures, bribery, fraud, cheating, duplicity, mutilation, murder, abduction, banditry, plunder, and violence. So you don't do those things. Surprise, surprise. Anyway, that whole last section there, I think, doesn't belong there. It has been added at some point. The parallels to the sutta don't have it there. So I think that is the right reading. Anyway, so that is just for your amusement, so you can see a little bit more about the monastic ideals. These things are not things you need to worry too much about unless you go on an 8-precept retreat, in which case you will have to think about these things as well. So, time going quickly as usual. Let's do a little bit more meditation together and then have some Q&A afterwards. Gee. Okay, maybe let's stop there. I'm going to make use of this wonderful generosity. Okay, everyone. So, would you anyone like to comment on anything or ask any questions or anything? Yeah. Please. Yeah. Yeah, good point. Yeah, the trees have a very important role right now in this juncture of history when we have the problems that we have. So, yeah, that's absolutely true. Huh? So, yeah, good. Anyone else want to say yes, please? Yeah, the five characteristics of speech. Yeah, I mean, there's a number of suttas where the Buddha talks about speaking in the right way. For example, if you want to correct someone, for example, you know, what kind of... I think maybe that's what you're thinking of. If you want to correct someone that made a mistake, how do you do that in a good way? And it's like speaking at the right time, speaking with a heart of loving kindness, speaking what is... beneficial. I can't remember now what they are. Yeah. So I think there are maybe the one is applied specifically if someone needs to be corrected because what they're doing doesn't work or whatever. But these are more kind of general characteristic of speech at any particular time. Maybe that was a difference.
Yeah, thank you. I didn't realize that was the sort of
context.
The,
yeah.
Context.
Yeah.
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 Thank you.
Good. Yeah. Yes, please. Yeah.
Just a quick clarifying question around the word scrupulous up top. They're scrupulous and kind.
Yeah.
What does that exactly mean? I'm just thinking scrupulous. I think in terms of financial.
Yeah. Well, I think it just means that you are careful. Scrupulous means like careful. I think. Yeah. So. Maybe that is a word that is not so used in American English. I don't know. English is such a diverse language, and it's weird because after I started translating quite a bit myself, I realized that if you want to, you know, there's like different tribes of English, and they use a different vocabulary. And there's things that aren't used here in the US, which are used like in Australia or Britain or whatever. Yeah. One of the words I found out was fortnight. Yeah, I realize it's actually not really used in the U.S. You know what it means, probably, huh? But in England and Australia, it's used all the time. It means 2 weeks, right? A fortnight is 2 weeks, and that's kind of it's weird when these things happen. But let me let's have a quick look because so scrupulous. Yeah, here you are. Scrupulous means like. Careful, meticulous, painstaking, thorough. Huh? Yeah? So that's essentially what I was getting at, I think. I think I got it right. Yeah. Yeah. Happy with that? Yeah? Okay. Yes, sir.
In English, I mean American English, we use the word unscrupulous.
Right. Right. Yeah, unscrupulous means like you're a bit of a bandit, basically. You don't really care about the consequences of your actions, and you just kind of go for it or whatever. Yeah, right. Yeah. That is correct. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, I don't know if this is really a question, but this is my experience and what's coming to my mind, and I kind of want your perspective on it. So, I understand as well. So they said, you know, we would call them indulgences.
Mm.
So it seems like they're both extremes, more about the middle way. And it also, yeah, that's what it means to avoid all entertainment. And I understand this is monastic, but it seems like it's almost an avoidance, could be an aspect of avoiding or also denying human nature and the beauty of being human. And yeah, so like I said, I don't know if there's a question in there, but that has always been something that, like, how do I work with this?
How you work with it is that you do things very gradually. Yeah. If you try to do things too fast, you're going to suffer enormously. If you try to give up all your pleasures in life and you haven't got any alternative, it's going to be really hard, right? You're going to commit suicide before you can count to three, and you know, and that's not the point. So you have to do things very gradually, and you have to kind of see why certain pleasures get in the way of the spiritual practice. And when you see that, then you kind of substitute one for the other, and it starts to become really beautiful. It's almost like natural, yeah? You're inclining toward what feels right, and it's no issue at all. So a lot of these things are, you know, this being celibate. I mean, first of all, I'm sure you agree with kind of the idea of using sexuality in a responsible way, right? I'm sure you agree with that. You can't just take advantage of people and that kind of stuff. So that's already setting certain limits, right? So we already accept certain limits. Then you take those limits a bit further, and you kind of gradually do this kind of substitution, and then it kind of happens by itself. Yeah, it's not something that is unnatural or unpleasant or anything like that. Then there's this idea of human nature, and this is kind of a common argument, but it's human nature to kind of, you know, to enjoy the world and have relationships and all of these kind of things. But the point is that human nature is very broad. There isn't like one human nature. We make this mistake to think that that is the only possible human nature. There is another human nature, which is to enjoy meditation and not to enjoy those things. Because the point is that if you do enjoy those deep meditations, you're actually happy. It comes natural to reject those other things, yeah? That is, you're no longer going against the nature at all. In fact, you're following an alternative human nature. Yeah? These are alternative human natures, depending on how you look at the world and how your mind is developed, etc., etc. Yeah? So this is the thing, just because what we see around us, everyone is doing the same thing, we assume that is the only possible human nature, but actually it isn't. It depends on how you develop your mind, what you do with yourself, how you live. That is what decides, ultimately, what your particular nature is. And of course, the mind is going to wobble a bit, right? It's going to go a little bit back and forth. It's not going to be stable. Sometimes it's going to be more spiritual. Sometimes it's going to have more desires for worldly things. I mean, we all know what that is like, yeah? The mind kind of wobbling. And so it's not straightforward, but there's a kind of in spiritual life, there's kind of general trend going upwards in one direction. And within that trend, there's going to be like a bit up and down, a bit wavy. Yeah, so some days you feel really, oh wow, now I've really got my act together. Other days you feel down in the dumps, and then you kind of go up again, and you kind of. But the trend is kind of heading in one way. Yeah.
So you're saying it's just the more you keep meditating, the mind just naturally starts not wanting to listen to music, or not wanting to see works of art, or that type of stuff.
Yeah. Not just meditating, but the whole practice of the path overall. Right? The whole practice of the path is what makes meditation possible anyway. Yeah, but all of these things together kind of go in that direction. Now, one of the things that the Buddha does, and he does that in a number of suttas, he talks about the downside of the sensory realm, the sensory world. So it's also about reflecting on those things. Yeah, what are the limitations of the sensory world? Does it have some downsides? And the Buddha has some beautiful similes. Have I got those similes here? That's a good question. I can't remember when I got here. I think I may do, actually. And yeah, okay, I think we have... Let's see here. I hope we get through all of this. Yeah, they're coming towards the very end. And this is the similes on the downside of sensual pleasures, or the sensory world. So we're going to get to that. And then you... When you start to reflect on that, that also will then lean your mind in the direction of the spiritual practice, right? So all of these things kind of come together here. Yeah. All right, let's carry on a little bit. So... we have looked at the idea of... ordinary morality in quite a bit of detail. And once the ordinary morality has kind of been put in place, the morality of speech, the morality of action, the next one is the morality of mind. How do we keep a pure mind? Mind which doesn't, we don't avoid having ill will and avoid excessive desires and these kind of things. This is the next level of morality. So this is what... happens next here. So this is the famous passage on contentment, right? So you are content with robes to look after the body and alms food to look after the belly. Wherever you go, you set out taking only these things. You're like a bird. Wherever it flies, wings are its only burden. In the same way, a mendicant is content with robes to look after the body and alms food to look after the belly. Wherever you go, you set out taking only these things. When they have this whole spectrum of noble ethics, they experience a blameless happiness inside themselves. So this is the idea of being content, right? And so you, ideally, as a monastic, you only have robes to look after the body. This is this stuff, and you have a bowl, alms bowl. I don't this actually only says alms food here, but you need to kind of have an alms bowl as well to look after your belly. And this is the kind of ideal monastic. All they have is a bowl and robes. They don't have a laptop, right? This is this is additional. This is kind of this is a sign of a monk who's already going slightly astray when you have a laptop like this. So. But it's very inspiring, and sometimes we see these examples lived really well in certain places. You see monastics who only have basically all their possessions, they have what they're wearing, and they have the ball, maybe they have a tiny bag over the shoulder, maybe have a razor or something like that in the bag, yeah. And that's pretty much it. And they live like that, wandering around. And when you see that, there's something very inspiring about that, because... you know that someone who lives like that, just moving from place to place, resting at the foot of a tree, finding an empty hut somewhere, and just living in simplicity, you know that they must have another source of happiness. And then you meet them, and they are bright, and they are shiny, and they are wise, yeah? And it's like, what's going on here? And it opens up the kind of... The view of something larger, something more profound, something very interesting when you see these things. So I don't know about you, but I find that very inspiring when I see that. There was a famous monk in Sri Lanka. He was actually German by birth. He was known as Venerable Nyanavimala. And he came to... Have you heard about him? Maybe? Yeah, okay. And he came to Sri Lanka back in the 1930s, and he had some kind of experience in the interwar period in Germany. And when he saw these things, like, okay, I'm out of here. And so he left to Sri Lanka and became a monk. And he went to a very famous place in Sri Lanka called the Island Hermitage, which was established by another monk, Nana Tiloka, previously. And that's where a lot of the Western monks kind of came together. I think often is like that. Yeah, if you belong to a certain nationality, you kind of hang out together. That kind of seems to be the way things are often. So all the Western monks kind of hung out down there, and Vimalananda Vimala was one of them. And while he was staying there, he would read the suttas. But he wouldn't just read them, he would memorize them, yeah, by heart, I think in Pali language. And the reason he did that, because he wanted to internalize the Tipitaka. Maybe not the whole Tipitaka, but large, important suttas. So when he would set out walking, he didn't have a laptop like me. He was a real deal. So when he set out walking, he didn't need any books. You can't, in those days there weren't laptops anyway. You had to carry books around. That was too cumbersome. So he remembered all the suttas, right? So he spent 10 years on this island learning the suttas. And when he knew enough, and he had kind of enough instructions in meditation from his immediate teachers. Then he set out wandering. And he wandered around the island on Sri Lanka for something like 40 years. Yeah, 40 years, just wandering all the time. Never really settling anywhere, except for the rainy season, when you're supposed to settle down for 3 months. And that's kind of amazing. That's kind of really amazing. And not only did he do that, but he actually also was a very wise and very profound meditator. My teacher, Ajahn Brahm, he went to Sri Lanka, and he met him by accident in Colombo. So Ajahn Brahm went to this monastery in Colombo called Vajirarama. You know Vajirarama in Colombo? Yeah? It's a famous monastery in Colombo. And in those days, back in the 90s, there were many of the most famous monks in Sri Lanka. They were staying there. And one of the monks who was staying there was Bhikkhu Bodhi. Yeah? So he was staying there because he was in Sri Lanka, right? He's kind of one of your American jewels, yeah, right here. Not far from here, actually, just a few hours south in New York State. His Chonyang Monastery, that's where he's hanging out. I went to visit him on the way up here. And so Bhikkhu Bodhi was there, right? So Ajahn Brahm came to visit Bhikkhu Bodhi. And then Ajahn Brahm asks Bhikkhu Bodhi, asks him, well, is there any other monk I should visit while I'm here? Bhikkhu Bodhi thinks, actually, there is. There's this old German monk, yeah, he's really amazing. So he kind of takes Ajahn Brahm in and introduces him to Venerable Nyana Vimala. And so then Ajahn Brahm sits down. And then Bhikkhu Bodhi thinks, yeah, okay, I'm just going to do some work while the two of you kind of have a chat together. And then after a while, Bhikkhu Bodhi kind of hears the voice of Nyana Vimala kind of, you know, roaring in that room. Yeah, the Dhamma talk is kind of being expounded, and it goes on for 2 or 3 hours or something. And then Ajahn Brahm comes out big-eyed afterwards, right, kind of large eyes. And Bhikkhu Bodhi knew at that time he should never have left that room. He should have stayed for that Dhamma talk. It was one of the biggest mistakes that he made in his life. It's so difficult to get a Dhamma talk out of this monk, right? It's so rare that he will give a Dhamma talk. Whoa, that was a big mistake. And Ajahn Brahm told me later on that was the best Dhamma talk that he had ever heard. Right? And Ajahn Brahm has met some pretty amazing monks in his life. He was a disciple of Ajahn Chah, who is considered by many to be maybe the greatest meditation master in Thailand, yeah, in the 20th century. Ajahn Brahm traveled around the northeast of Thailand, where many of these meditation masters lived. So Ajahn Brahm had met all of these monks, but this was for him the kind of the pinnacle, yeah. And maybe it could be a cultural thing, because when you listen to someone from your own culture, then maybe there's more meeting points, so maybe it's easier to kind of things to go in there. So it may not have been that he was a greater monk in the kind of a final sense, but just that there was more a meeting of minds, perhaps. I don't know the reason. But anyway, that was this monk, right? Walking around the island, becoming super wise. And many people said he was an arahant. I don't know. Who knows what he was, but that's kind of the claim by some people. So this is this ideal, and you find it in the suttas. And it's still being practiced by some people to the present day. Actually, he's passed away now, this monk. But still, you find this ideal in the world. And it's kind of inspiring. I remember Bhante Sujato, when he was living at Bodhinyana Monastery. And one day he was leaving, right? And I saw him leaving the monastery. And he had one bag on his shoulder. One kind of bag, a bit like, I don't have my bag here. Okay, I can't see my bag. Just a kind of fairly small bag. And I said to him, well, where are all your belongings? And he just pointed to the bag. Everything is in here. And he was leaving the monastery, right? He had been staying there for a year or something. That was all his belongings. And then he kind of walked out the gate, yeah? Like this kind of I like this kind of movie where someone rides off into the sunset. He walks out of the gate with nothing, right? And this, it is very inspiring. Yeah. And then it's very easy to travel, very easy to do things. And me too, when I travel, I try to travel very lightly. I never have any kind of check-in baggage. I always travel just with carry-on baggage because it makes life so easy. Yeah, wherever I go in the world, because it makes life very simple when you do that. So I try to minimize things. I had to scratch my head a bit when I come to the, everyone says the US is very cold right now. And I went to Minneapolis. I was in the Midwest. Minneapolis was minus 10 when I was there, right? I didn't even have socks, but it was actually okay. It was no problem there. So it's interesting how these things work out. Anyway, if you really need anything, people were desperate to support me. You haven't got any socks? Please take our socks. I said, no need. You must take our socks. It's very kind of very sweet because people really, really look after you anyway. Yeah. So, yeah, you have this is all you have. And then wherever you go, you set out only with these things with you. You're like a bird, and wherever the bird flies, wings are its only burden. Yeah, that's all you have. Like your wings, because wings are necessary. If you haven't got wings, you are in trouble as a bird. In the same way, if you're a monk, if you haven't got an arms bone, you haven't got robes, well, you're in trouble. That's the minimum requirement. So basically, you are not barely burdened at all. A tiny little bit of burden left. And then when you do this, you have this whole spectrum of noble ethics. You will notice the beautiful word noble there, noble ethics. Yeah, when you live in this way, already you're becoming noble. So if you're living like this, approximating to this, you're becoming noble. Is that cool? That's a nice idea, isn't it? I think this is kind of one of the things I like about the suttas, is that they, when you do something well and you live in a good way, you actually get, they praise you for that. You're called a noble person if you live in a good way, yeah? And I think sometimes in the world we underestimate too much the good things that we do. And it's okay to feel good about yourself if you live well, yeah? We don't have to deprecate ourselves all the time and put ourselves down. I think sometimes we do too much of that. And as long as it doesn't kind of bolster your ego and you become an egomaniac, of course that's a bad idea. But a quiet sense of feeling good about yourself is not only acceptable, it is actually a positive thing to do that. Remember Ajahn Brahm is a very funny person, but he got some kind of award. At one of the universities in Perth, they wanted to give him an award for leadership because he was one of the great leaders of the Buddhist community in Perth. And so he went to this ceremony, right? And he was listening to the speeches of everyone else, and everyone else was saying, yeah, oh, thank you for this award, but I wouldn't have been able to do this if it wasn't for all these other people who supported me, right? They were kind of downplaying their own contribution. And it's kind of the polite thing to do, right? But Ajahn Brahm said, I'm not going to say that. I'm going to say, thank you very much. Well, he didn't. I don't think he said that at the ceremony, but he said it to us afterwards, said, tongue in cheek, thank you very much, I deserve that. And, you know, and he probably did, right? Otherwise, would they have given it to him if he didn't deserve it? He probably did deserve it, right? So fair enough. And you may think that Ajahn Brahm is some kind of big ego person. Actually, he's the exact opposite. He's the least kind of person with the least ego that I have ever known in my life. So when he says these things, it's not because of big ego. It's just a kind of natural, it's a very natural feeling about, you know, if you do something good, okay, why not? You know, it's fine. It's okay to do good things. And you're allowed to feel good about that. So when you have this whole spectrum of ethics, noble ethics, yeah, you're getting noble, you experience a blameless happiness inside of yourself. Yeah, you feel good about yourself. There's nothing to be blamed. There's nothing, no recriminations. There's no sense of, you know, feeling of remorse or anything like that. You just feel happy with yourself. And this is the beginning of why meditation works, why meditation has to be based on ethics. Why? Because you feel good about yourself. When you feel good about yourself, you want to be present. Right? If you feel bad about yourself, you've done bad things, your mind wants to escape. So you think about the future, think about the past, you fantasize, all of these kind of things. But when you feel good about yourself, when you're happy within, mindfulness becomes possible because you want to be here. It's really as simple as that. Yeah. So that is what this is about. So this is the idea of being content. And here we are now moving into the area of mental virtue. Because when you are content, you have less greed and all of these kind of things. This is also about the right livelihood, because this is the livelihood of a monastic. So we're now moving gradually into the area of mental purity and mental simplicity. Contentment is a great mental virtue. And it's not just for monastics. Yeah, I would recommend all of you to develop the idea of contentment in your life. To think that what you have is good enough, yeah, whatever, my family is good enough, my job is good enough, or maybe it isn't, but then get a new one, right? I come to a point where it's good enough. What I own in this world is good enough, as long as you have a reasonable house, enough food, you know, to keep you fed and these kind of things, yeah? And try to see what you have with the contented eyes, so you're not always kind of looking for more, because that search for more is endless. There's a beautiful saying in the Dhammapada that contentment is the highest wealth. Yeah, it's a beautiful saying, because the reality is that no matter how much you have, if you are, what is the richest person in the world right now? I don't know, it keeps fluctuating, I don't know. It used to be Bill Gates, then it was Elon Musk for a while, not sure who is the richest one now. Someone is probably the richest anyway. If you're the richest person in the world, if you are not content, it means you need more. So you haven't got enough yet, right? But the person who is content doesn't need more, and that's why that is the highest wealth. It's kind of obvious when you think about it. And so if you're content, you don't need anything more. But if you're the wealthiest person in the world, you're not content, it means you need more. And that is kind of problematic. So you might as well be content now. No need to kind of try to get more and still be discontent. That kind of doesn't make any sense. Idea of contentment. Are you content with the idea of contentment? Yeah? Makes sense. Okay, so now we're going to carry on with the idea of mental purity. And now we're going to come to one of the very important paragraphs on how to deal with the mind and how to purify the mind. And this is kind of one of the core exhibits on this during this retreat. And this is called the Buddhist idea of sense restraint. How to restrain the senses. What this means, what we are trying to do here, we're trying to avoid, the main thing we're trying to avoid is to get upset and angry in life. How can we reduce anger? Because anger is so problematic, it causes so much suffering for ourselves and others, and it just really is destructive of the spiritual path and everything. So if you can reduce anger even more, not that you don't look like a very angry bunch at all, but you know, even if you are already very subdued, maybe we can take that even further down and develop more loving kindness and compassion instead. So this is the main thing here. The other thing is also to reduce desires a bit more. This is what this is about. This is why it is very interesting here. I'm going to talk about this in quite a bit of detail. So when they see a sight with their eyes, they don't get caught in the features or the details. If the faculty of sight were left unrestrained, bad, unskillful qualities of desire and aversion would become overwhelming. For this reason, they practice restraint, protecting the faculty of sight and achieving its restraint. Yeah, so when you see something with the eye, yeah, whatever that might be, yeah, see things, okay, you don't get caught up in the features or the detail. The features, like maybe the main picture, the details might be like one person, right? So you're like the detail, the picture is the whole thing. You don't get caught up in those things. What does that mean, getting caught up in things? Well, what it means is that I see you, I can think of you either as a friend or as an enemy. I mean, in this case, obviously friend. But it might be an enemy in some other occasion, right? When you see someone in a certain way, when someone is attractive to you, that image of that person lingers in your mind because you are attracted to that person. Or you are hungry and you walk past the restaurant, you see the food, okay? You can't get that image of the food out of your mind. Or you walk past the cake shop at the wrong time and can't get it out of your mind. You know what it's like? Sometimes these things linger in your mind. And when these things are stuck in your mind, that is what it means to be caught by these things, yeah? It can also be aversion. You see someone you don't like, someone you had problems with in the past, and then that negative feeling lingers in your mind, yeah? And it kind of, you can't really move on. And when things linger in your mind in this way, you can't move on, you can't really be mindful. Because mindfulness means that you are aware as you move on in life, yeah? You take in the new object, you don't kind of get stuck on what happened in the past, but you move on with things in life. That's what the idea of being mindful. You are present with whatever is going on. So this, if we don't have this kind of sense restraint, we lose our mindfulness and we get stuck in our mind, hanging out with images and things from the past, either in a negative way or in a positive way, either because we are attracted or because we are repelled by something. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay, so what do we do then? So we don't get caught up in these things, yeah? So if the faculty of sight was left unrestrained, Jeepers. I apologize for this, I can't really help it, unfortunately. If the faculty of sight were left unrestrained, bad, unskillful qualities of desire and aversion would become overwhelming. Right? So if we don't watch what is going on, and we just allow the eye to kind of linger on whatever it wants to linger in the world, yeah, like most people do. Yeah, you get desires coming up, aversions coming up, and sometimes those aversions can go into ill will and anger, all of these kind of things, and we can get very bad and negative qualities of the mind arising because of that. So what it is saying then, we need to have some restraint to stop these bad qualities from arising. We want to have a mind that is even. We don't want to have a mind that is buffeted around, going up, going down, always following kind of the desires and aversions in life. But we want to have a mind that is even in life, that has a sense of equanimity. This is like the beginning of equanimity, an even mind. And what you start to find, of course, is that if you have an even mind, you feel much better about yourself. This mind that is always ricocheting up and down like a yo-yo, yeah, sometimes happy because, wow, I'm really indulging and having a good time, then down in the dumps because you get angry or depressed and kind of up and down like this. It's actually not a pleasant way to live. But the even mind that is cool, that just observes, yeah, and is kind of not dull, not in a dull kind of way, but in a sharp kind of way, that is kind of the mind that is really worthwhile having here. So we're trying to find a balance in life, less being buffeted by the storms of desire and aversion. So for this reason, you practice restraint, protecting the eye faculty and achieving its restraint. So this is the interesting part. So first of all, protecting the eye faculty, what does that mean? The Pali here is, what is it? Gutta dvara, I think. Gutta means to protect, yeah? So the idea of protection in the Pali Suttas is always happens through mindfulness. Mindfulness protects. Mindfulness is aware of what is going on. If you're going to have success in this kind of sense restraint, the minimum requirement is to be aware of what's happening in your mind, yeah? Without that mindfulness, without having the ability to be aware of what is going on, there's no way you can restrain anything because you won't be able to take action in time. So the first thing is always to be aware. So awareness or mindfulness is actually a very important part of this. And you can now start to get the feeling that the quality of mindfulness has many different levels, right? There is the most a rudimentary kind of mindfulness that is required to be moral. If you're going to be kind to other people, you have to have awareness of what you are doing, whether you're doing the right thing. Yeah, in daily life, mindfulness is required just to do the right thing. Am I acting in the right way? Am I speaking in the right way? Otherwise, it's not going to work out. But here, we're taking the mindfulness to a slightly higher level, because here, it is mindfulness also about what is your reaction to things in the world. Am I reacting to things with desire and aversion, with ill will and excessive greed, and these kind of things? So here mindfulness is kind of one step higher. You start to become more aware generally in your life. This, of course, is very important as a monastic, because as a monastic you don't have the same stresses as you have in lay life. Is that true? It's stressful, lay life, right? Is that right for all, every one of you? Nods. Okay, yeah. So there you are. Sometimes monastic life can even be a bit stressful, but usually lay life much more stressful than monastic life. So this is actually more difficult. Another reason why monastic life is good. Less stress, more ability to have a clear mind, more ability to do sense restraint. Yeah. So all of these things, you can start to see, there's many, many different angles from which you can understand the power of monastic life. But when you have to work, you have a family, you have all of these things in your life, of course, it's gonna, your life is very full, and it's much more difficult to have that degree of mindfulness in your life. So this takes a degree of mindfulness. So this is the kind of the second degree of mindfulness. Then beyond this is the mindfulness you need to actually do meditation practice. If you want to do meditation practice, real, full meditation, as is described in the Anapanasati Sutta on the mindfulness of breathing, you need another level of mindfulness again. Clarity, no thinking really at all, or very little thinking. Yeah, and a degree of clarity, and just being at ease with the breath. So mindfulness has many different levels, and it's important to know what particular level we are dealing with. Yeah? Otherwise, you will use it wrongly at that particular stage. So here is enough mindfulness to be able to guard the senses, to know whether aversion or desire is about to arise. Yeah, you can see what is happening. You can see if I look at this person a bit longer, I'm going to get irritated. Okay, let me go somewhere else. People are irritating here. You know what I mean? People, it's very fascinating with people, because people are the things that we are most dear to us in this world, and they're also the things that are most difficult in this world. Kind of this duality. And for that reason, we need to, you know, people, is when we talk about sense restraint, other people is a very, very important part of this. So, all right, so now we are assuming that we have that mindfulness, ability to be aware, we can see whether aversion or desire is about to arise. Then the second thing is to have the strategy to overcome that desire and aversion, right? That is the second factor. How do we do it? If we look at someone and we can feel that we're about to get angry with somebody, what do we do at that particular point? And that is really the critical thing here. And you may think that because this is talking about sense restraint, you kind of just restrain, you just hold, you grasp, you use willpower on that anger to hold it back. That is what it may sound like, because restraint in English often means grasping things, holding things. But as you quite rightly understand, you already not. So you know already, that is not really the answer, right? That doesn't really work. And the answer, and we shall see at this later on, the answer, ideal answer to restrain from these things is actually to use wisdom instead. And I'll go into this in quite a bit of detail to show you how to use wisdom to enable the mind to stay in this beautiful, even space. Okay, so let us do a little bit more meditation together and then come back to the remainder of this later on. Yeah. Okay, so any comments or questions, or anyone like to add anything or say anything? Yeah. Yes, please, Shirley. Yeah, that would be restraint, but that is a restraint of a much higher order. Yeah. That is like really high. Yeah, this is like what the ideal for the arahant almost. That's the Bahya Sutta, the famous sutta, where in the scene, let there just be the scene, and the hurla. And that is kind of very elevated dhamma. This is much more this is much more practical. This is for you. This is for you, Shirley. I guarantee you. This is, I guarantee you. Guarantee you can do this. Absolutely, you can do this one. You may not be able to do the Bahya Sutta because that is really elevated. But this one, this is for every person in this room, including myself. So this is just about, you know, noticing that sometimes in life, in certain situations are more irritating than others. Certain situations trigger our defilements. You know. Just noticing that and then kind of having the strategies ready to deal with that. That's really what this is about. So it's not, the way it is phrased, it may sound a bit kind of highfalutin or whatever, but actually it is just ordinary experience in the world as we go through the world and we see desires, we see ill will and the things arising and how we deal with that in the right way. But it is important to catch these things quite early, and that's why mindfulness is important. You don't want that mindful, that ill will to become too strong. Once it is too strong, it's hard to get rid of. But if you catch it early on, then usually you're able to deal with it and kind of turn your mind in a different direction. So this is more, this is much more basic and much more very practical, very pragmatic teaching. Oh, okay. That would be wonderful. I would love that. Yeah. yes. So thank you for that question. That's a good question. Yeah. Anyone else want to say anything? Yeah. Yeah. If hopefully today there will be a chance of also writing questions down. Some people are maybe a bit shy of asking in public, and if you feel that way, you're very welcome to write things down instead. Yeah. Good, so no more questions? Wow. Great, so let's then move on. I wanted to also ask, is everyone okay with the schedule that we're having here? Are you feeling all right with that? Yeah? Okay, mm-hmm. Good, yeah? Because it's maybe a bit more intensive teaching than maybe what you're used to on retreats. But it said the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies. I thought, okay, maybe we should study a bit more. I don't know. I was just kind of looking at the name. So.
You keep interspersing it with meditation, which is great.
Yeah, okay, good. At least enough to kind of allow things to sink in a little bit. Yeah. Good, yeah. So, yeah. Okay, so let's just finish off this little paragraph. Now it's more of the same. It's the same relating to all the other senses, including the mind. So just read it out. So when they hear a sound with their ears, when they smell an odor with their nose, when they taste a flavor with the tongue, when they feel a touch with the body, when they know a thought with their mind, they don't get caught up in the features and details. Yes, the mind also. Sometimes we think things and just our own thoughts sometimes make us upset. You know what it's like? You think about the wrong thing and it kind of, you remember something or whatever and it upsets you. So even with our own thoughts, we need to follow the same kind of strategy. If the faculty of mind were left unrestrained, bad unwholesome qualities of desire and aversion would become overwhelming. Yeah, so it's about avoiding the bad outcomes. A little bit of desire and aversion is very hard to overcome completely, but the idea is to stop them becoming stronger. For this reason, they practice restraint, protecting the faculty of mind and achieving its restraint. When they have this noble sense restraint, they experience an unsullied bliss inside themselves. So that's kind of nice, isn't it? First of all, you have the previous one, you have the bliss of being blameless because you're not doing anything wrong. But even though you are blameless, if you still have all of these defilements of the mind, it may feel like it's a bit sullied. It's not kind of clean, yeah? But once the mind also gets rid of the worst kind of defilements, it feels like you're being purified in a sense, yeah? It's unsullied kind of happiness. It is not a happiness mixed with bad qualities of the mind. That's kind of the idea here. This is one of the things on the path, yeah? Happiness, more happiness, deeper and deeper as you go along. Blameless happiness, unsullied happiness, and then we have the even deeper happiness of meditation coming up very soon. Yeah, one after the other. You know, you read Ajahn Brahm's book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond. There's one chapter called Bliss, one called Bliss Upon Bliss, one chapter called Bliss Upon Bliss Upon Bliss. So he's really, but that's what the Buddha's teaching, right? So it kind of fits very well with the teachings here. Yeah. So now, what next? I think we should go to the next sutta. We should skip the remainder of this sutta, come back to this later on. That's the theory anyway. We'll see what happens down the track. We'll come back to this. In the meantime, we... Thank you so much. This is very, very kind of you. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Feeling better already. That's good. So, we're going to look at the sutta called The Two Kinds of Thoughts, which is the next one. Majjhima Nikaya, Middle Length Sayings, number 19. This is the Dveda Vitakka Sutta in Pali. This is the Buddha talking about his own life before his awakening. In other words, what he did to overcome bad thinking. Yeah, that's really what this is about. And as I mentioned before, the reason why the Buddha teaches in this way is because he wants us to follow in his footsteps. Yeah, the Buddha is a human being. His mind is defiled. Maybe not as defiled as the rest of us, but, you know, it still has defilements. And so he has to deal with these defilements. What does he do? And it tells us this, that we should be doing the same thing. And this is what I was mentioning before about the idea of knowing the Buddha as a human being, so that these instructions actually become meaningful to us. Dveda Vitakka Sutta. Let's see what the Buddha says here. So I have heard. At one time, the Buddha was staying near Savati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. There the Buddha addressed the mendicants. Mendicants, venerable sir, they replied, and the Buddha said this. So this is how most of the suttas start. Yeah, so I have heard, it's an oral transmission being passed down from generation to generation. And the Buddha is staying near Savati, that's where he would very often stay, in the Jeta Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. It was a very famous monastery. You can still go to Savati in the present day and see the same monastery. It is still there. It is not operational anymore, of course, but there are ruins there. And you can kind of hang out among those ruins. And that's kind of nice. It's in the faraway corner of India. It's in a place that, you know, there is nothing really there. So actually it's quite peaceful in this part, and except if you get 10 busloads of tourists rocking up exactly the time you come there. This is surprisingly common. I remember all these busloads of tourists coming while I was there, and very often they have loudspeakers, yeah, and they... Can they have a tour leader with a loudspeaker telling them about everything to see, and you just try to sit down and meditate, and it's just, you know, it makes it very, very, very challenging, very interesting in that sense. So that's kind of par for the course. That's the way it is. But these places are there, and you can still see them. And then the Buddha addressed the mendicants, the monastics. And they say, Venerable Sir, or Sir, right? And then the Buddha speaks. Mendicants, before my awakening, when I was still unawakened, but intent on awakening, I thought, why don't I meditate by dividing my thoughts into two classes? So before my awakening, so he's still struggling to find the way through, right? While I was still unawakened, but intent on awakening, and this word intent on awakening here, this is the word bodhisatta, right? Which is translated by Bhantasarata as intent on awakening, which I think is the right kind of translation. And what that means is that the moment he is intent on awakening is a time when he leaves the household life, because then he leaves that because he wants to achieve this, right? So from that moment on, he's intent on awakening. And that from that moment on, he is a bodhisattva. So this is what we're seeing. It's what I was mentioning before. I just hear it comes out in the actual sutta. So before his awakening, and he says that he's dividing his thoughts into two classes. So what are these two classes? So I assigned sensual, malicious, and harmful or harming thoughts to one class. And I assigned thoughts of renunciation, goodwill, and compassion to the second class. Right? So he assigns his thoughts into two groupings. The first one, sensual thoughts, or you could say thoughts about the sensory world. Sensual to me is a little bit too close to maybe lust or desire, but this is like any thoughts really about the five sense worlds, a very broad category of things. And then you have the thoughts of ill will or malicious thoughts, where you feel kind of ill will towards other people. And then you have the last one here, which he translates as cruel. But really, it is more a kind of mindset where we don't care. We are inconsiderate. We are unscrupulous. Is that the word? Unscrupulous. So we are not considerate of our actions, how it affects other beings. So these are the three kinds of, let me come back to that in a second. And on the other side is then the opposites. Renunciation is kind of giving up an interest in the sensory world to elevate our mind out of that into the higher realms of meditation. Then the thoughts of goodwill, which is the opposite of ill will. And then the thoughts of compassion, which is the opposite of being inconsiderate, not caring about our effects on other beings. So these are the two classes. And you may think, isn't this very kind of rudimentary? Hasn't he figured this out a long time ago? Isn't this bleeding obvious? You know the word bleeding, right? This is kind of an English expression, means like it's not considered rude these days. People these days use far worse slang than that. But it's a bit kind of slang, bleeding obvious. Anyway, whatever. But the idea, remember the, it is actually quite difficult to do this fully, because many of these things have very, very subtle aspects to them. So thinking about the five sense world can be incredibly subtle. To fully understand what thinking about the five sense world is about, you can really only understand that when you come to a jhana state, when you come to a state of very profound meditation. Because unless you remove yourself from the five sense world completely, you can't really understand what it is. It's the old simile of the tadpole. The tadpole doesn't know what water is because it's always been immersed in water. But come a frog one day, jump out of the water. Okay, now I get it. That was what water was. So you have to remove yourself before you can understand these things. It's the same thing with understanding sensual thoughts. So this is actually quite hard to do. It is obvious when the sensual thoughts are very strong. Okay, then of course we all know what it means. But the tiny thoughts, the tiny attachments we have to that world, when you are sitting in meditation, you're perfectly peaceful, you don't have any thoughts about the five sense world at all, and still your mind is stuck. Well, probably this is the problem, right? That's how subtle it is. Ill will is kind of more obvious, but all that too can come in all kind of degrees, from the kind of greatest rage to the kind of most subtle irritation. All of that is kind of within the scope of ill will. And the last one here is actually quite interesting. This is the idea of harming. He has cruelty, which is not entirely wrong, but it's, I think it's too narrow. It's just the idea that you don't care about the consequences of your actions. It's about the business person who kind of just forges ahead because the business is so important. And if you kind of step on all kinds of people on the way, actually you don't really care about that because your business is what matters. Yeah, or I mean, like, probably many business people, it's easy to be a bit like that because obviously business is important, yeah? And you don't fully acknowledge the consequences of your business. Maybe the impact it has on the environment or whatever, yeah? This, if you kind of just do your business without caring about the environment, you're being callous, you're being inconsiderate, and this is what this is about. Or you walk down the path and there's all these ants walking on the path, and you don't care. It's not that you're angry with the ants. It's just that you couldn't care less about whether you step on them or not. So you kind of walk all over those ants. Yeah, this is what this really is about. And it's the opposite of compassion. Compassion is when you care for living beings. You consider your impact and your imprint on the world. This is what compassion is about. Yeah, understanding the suffering of other beings. So these are the three kinds of thought. And it's kind of interesting. This last kind of thought is kind of interesting because we don't normally consider this as necessarily as bad, right? But it actually is bad. The idea of being inconsiderate is not something we consider as bad karma normally. But on this path, it is bad. Compassion is important. This is what this is saying. So you make these two classes of thoughts. And then the Buddha said, and here, he translated this, as I meditate. I don't like meditate because this is kind of throughout life. As I thought in this way, or as I was in this way, yeah. Thus, diligent, keen, and resolute, yeah. As I was thinking in this way, diligent, keen, and resolute. In other words, that very idea of dividing the your thinking world into two classes, that is what it means to be diligent and resolute, right? And that's kind of fascinating because very often we think about being diligent. It's kind of you do things, you get going, and you kind of... But here you can see this is actually an exercise in wisdom, the ability to divide the bad qualities from the good ones and do that properly and fully. It is, of course, it is an exercise of wisdom because you understand what has bad consequences and what has good consequences. So the idea here of diligent, keen, and resolute, things which seems to be effortful, you do things, actually it already points us in the direction of wisdom rather than using a lot of effort. That's interesting, isn't it? The way these words are used in the suttas are often quite different from how we normally think about them. Diligent, keen, and resolute, the Pali words are appamada, appamada, atapi, and pahitatta. Yes, I think so. Appamada, atapi, and paitatta. And atapi is very often used to mean exerting yourself, right? Paitatta is similar to padana, which is the sixth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, right effort. And so this shows that effort in Buddhism, very often just using your mind in a skillful and wise way, that is often the main aspect of effort. It's very important, I think, to remember because it shows us what we should be doing in ordinary life, yeah? How we should try to invoke wisdom whenever we can in our ordinary life. So, then, as you are doing this, essential thought arose. Let me go down to the malicious thought, because maybe that is, it's a little bit more easy to understand. So go one paragraph down. And then as I meditated, diligent, keen, and resolute, a malicious thought arose. I should say that, yeah, diligent, heedful, I think is a better translation. Appamada means like heedful. Diligent to me has this idea of you're working really hard, you're being diligent with your work. But heedful is more like you're careful, you're circumspect. And this is what this word really means. So don't fully agree with the translation diligent there. But anyway, you can see how we're having long arguments with each other here. No, we don't. We argue in a very civilized way, I can assure you. So, a malicious thought arose. I understood this malicious thought has arisen in me. Yeah, so this is the third thing. First thing to be aware of is that the malicious thought or the sensual thought has arisen. So this is what takes the mindfulness. This is what is guarding the mind. Yeah, you can see that these things arise inside of you. Once you know that, then you can do the right thing. Yeah, and the next thing then the Buddha thinks, or the Buddha to be thinks, he thinks it leads to hurting myself, hurting others, hurting both. It blocks wisdom. It's on the side of anguish, and it doesn't lead to extinguishment. So this is what the Buddha thinks when a bad thought arises in him, or the Buddha to be thinks. And you can see all of this is about wisdom. Yeah, this is about sense restraint, stopping these bad thoughts from arising. Yeah, so this is really in the area of sense restraint. And the way we do that restraint is by thinking in the right way. You understand that a malicious thought, it hurts me, it hurts other people, it hurts both. Yeah. How does that happen? Well, obviously, if you get angry, well, anger in its own right is not a very pleasant feeling. If you have the choice between anger and having goodwill, we would choose goodwill all the time, because it's a far more pleasant experience to have goodwill towards someone and to be angry towards someone. But also, anger is bad because it leads to lack of good judgment. Yeah, you start doing bad things when you're angry because you don't know up from down anymore. Yeah, we all become pretty stupid and deluded when we get angry. So we do bad things, so it's also bad for that reason. And of course, because we do bad things, it also leads to bad consequences down the track. Anger is one of the main reasons for all kinds of negative consequences, especially in the kind of rebirth idea. Yeah, we're going down the wrong track and heading to very bad consequences. So anger has a lot to answer for in this world. Anger has a lot of very negative consequences. And it is important to reflect on that. And the reason why it is important to reflect on that, because there's also a pleasure that comes with anger. If there was no pleasure that came with anger, you wouldn't get angry. There's a pleasure of feeling empowered, maybe. Yeah, anger gives you energy. Anger gives you a chance to kind of get things off your chest. I'm going to tell them off. Anger gives you the feeling of doing things or whatever, but there is a degree of pleasure in anger. And that is why we get angry. If there was no pleasure there at all, we would never get angry. So to remind yourself of the downside, to build up this understanding that it actually does hurt you, and this is also always the first thinking, is that actually hurts ourselves. That is actually very important to remind yourself of that. And then it hurts others. Yeah, it's kind of obvious. When you're angry, it will hurt other people. Yeah, they will feel bad in your presence if you get angry with them. I don't know about you, but if I am in the presence of angry people, I always feel a bit, it's not very nice, and you kind of sometimes you just want to remove yourself from that situation because it's just unpleasant. So you always hurt others when you're angry. And when you're angry with other people, you're not really giving them good advice anyway. Yeah, they deserve my anger, and so I'm going to tell them off. But actually, what you say is probably not all that useful because you're coming from anger. When we come from compassion and kindness, that is when we give good advice, because then we are neutral, and we see things in the right way. And so this is right. So again, we're hurting other people more. And then, of course, the last thing is that the reality is that most of the time we're actually hurting both at the same time, both ourselves and the other person. This is worth reflecting on. And the more you reflect on this, the more you understand this, the more your mind just withdraws. It doesn't even want to go there. And this is kind of the experience of someone like the Buddha, obviously, or someone who is very developed. You kind of pick up the hot coal of anger, and you don't need to think, should I let go of the hot coal? You instinctively, you just bang, you chuck it out, because that hot coal, you know it's going to burn you. Yeah, you make the mistake, you didn't know it was hot. Ah, it's hot, okay, throw it out. And that is where we want to be. We want to get to the point where it is instinctual. You just throw out the anger because you know it's going to be bad for everyone around. So you have to learn, we have to develop these perceptions a little bit. And this is part of this idea of seeing things with right view. This is part of right view, understanding that anger has negative consequences for everyone. So right view has so many different aspects to it. Yeah, but this is aligning your way of looking at the world or looking at people or whatever with the way the Buddha looked at the world. So this is how we overcome these things. And then he says, it blocks wisdom, right? When you are angry, you don't know up from down or black from white. Things are just, you have all kind of vested interest, which makes it impossible for you to see things clearly. So the panya nirodhika is the Pali. Literally means it makes wisdom cease. That's literally what it means. So bad news. Anyone here who doesn't want to be wiser? In that case, you can be angry. But everyone here, no one here wants, everyone here wants to be wise. That's good. So please avoid the wisdom destruction of anger. It's on the side of anguish. Yeah, it is painful in its own right. Not as only does it lead to hurting in the long run, it is painful right here if you see it in the right way. It doesn't lead, or it leads away from extinguishment. It leads away from nibbana. Yeah? So extinguishment, well, extinguishment means many things, but it means extinguishment of defilements, it means extinguishment of suffering, it means extinguishment of all the bad things. So it leads away from that. In other words, it leads to more inflammation, more flames. You're fanning the flames of greed, hatred, and delusion when you get angry. And that's bad news. This is good news. That is very nice. It kind of is nice to get a bit of heat to your throat. I think that works wonders. So thank you very much for that. So then the Buddha to be says, when I reflected that it leads to hurting myself, it went away. Just that reflection, right? It makes it go away. If you really reflect like that, fully, you fully understand that it's bad, it disappears just like that. When I reflected that it leads to hurting others, it went away. When I reflected that it leads to hurting both, it went away. When I reflected that it blocks wisdom, is on the side of anguish, and doesn't lead to extinguishment, it went away. So I gave it up, got rid of it, and eliminated any malicious thought that arose. So the words are quite strong. You gave it up, you got rid of it, eliminated it. And other translators use even stronger words in these cases. They use words like obliterate and that sort of stuff. A really, really powerful word. You obliterated it, annihilated it. Yeah, made it go to extinction or something like that. Really kind of strong words. But what is interesting, of course, is that even though the words in the Pali are very strong, it sounds like you're crushing something. It sounds like you're using enormous amount of willpower, right? All of these words suggest willpower. Just like restraint suggests willpower. Obliterate sounds like you're getting the sledgehammer out, right? That's what it sounds like. There's no sledgehammer. All there is wisdom all the way through, reflecting about things in the right way. Isn't that kind of interesting? There's an inclination of the mind here to think that we're using enormous amount of willpower, but no, it is actually wisdom power that is being used all the way through. So sometimes when you read the suttas, you have to read them with quite a lot of circumspection and to see what is really being said. Otherwise, you get the wrong end of the stick and then it doesn't work out for you. So wisdom power, that is what is powerful. And when you think about what is going on, this is a point I make whenever I teach these things. When you really think about what is going on and how thoughts in the mind are eliminated. If you just use willpower and restraint, what that means, it means you often kind of just crush it and you hold it down in your mind, right? I don't want to see that ill will. It's just too, don't want to have anything to do with it right now. This is inappropriate time to get angry, crush in the corner of your mind, right? And then after a while, that tires you out. Restraining, holding things down, using willpower is very tiring in the long run. And then when your energy is gone, you have exhausted your reserves of energy, it comes back again. Not always. Sometimes it stays, it's gone. But often it comes back again. And sometimes it comes back with a vengeance. And then you have no energy left to deal with it. So it doesn't really get rid of the problem, just restraining it. Or just holding it with willpower. But if you use wisdom power in the way that is suggested here, that you actually understand that this is really problematic, that this really does lead to hurting yourself, hurting others, and all of these kind of things. And when you see that clearly, it is gone completely like that. It does not appear again afterwards. It is actually gone. So wisdom power, if you want to obliterate these thoughts, if you want to eliminate them and get rid of them properly, actually the only way to do it is by wisdom power, not by willpower. And it leaves you with more energy because the willpower drains your energy. The wisdom power doesn't take much energy. It just takes the idea of turning your mind in the right direction. So wisdom power has all the advantages. The only downside of wisdom power, it takes more reflection, more contemplation to be able to gain that wisdom that enables you to do this. And this is why a very important part of the Buddhist path is to reflect again and again, contemplate, build up these ideas in your mind. So when the problem arises, you can use these ideas, pick them off the shelf in your mind, yeah, and use that force to stop and block that thought from arising. Yeah? So this is the idea behind this. So does that make sense to anyone here? Yeah? Few people nodding, okay. Anyone it does not make sense to? I'm going to keep on this subject for a while because it's a very important subject. I'm not going to let go of this too easily. So I'm going to bring in many more examples of how to do this because the more you kind of get into the idea, the more easy it will be for you to use this in practice in ordinary life.
It's uplifting. It's uplifting.
Good, yeah. I'm glad to hear that, because that's what I think as well. So, great, yeah. All right, so the Buddha to be then gives the same idea for the three kinds of thought, yeah, the sensual thought, the malicious thought, and the harming thought, and he says the same thing, yeah. If he knows it has arisen, he knows that it leads to hurting myself, hurting others, hurting both. Blocks wisdom, is on the side of anguish, leads away from extinguishment. When you reflect like this, in every instance, the thought goes away. Yeah, and this is the way to get rid of it, eliminate it, and giving it up. So, I'll read a little bit more here. Whatever a mendicant or anyone, layperson, whoever it is, frequently thinks about, and considers becomes their heart's inclination. If they often think about and consider sensual thoughts, yeah, or malicious thoughts, or cruel thoughts, they have given up the thought of renouncing, or the thought of loving kindness, or the thought of compassion, and they cultivate the opposite instead. And their mind inclines toward the negative thoughts. And then we have the same for malicious and cruel thoughts. And this is a very important point of the Dhamma, is this idea that, when our mind has a certain inclination, which depends on our conditioning from the past, depending on how we grew up, our past lives or whatever. So for most people, there's going to be a certain degree, especially of inclination towards sensuality, because this is such a prevalent thing in the human realm. There's also going to be that's maybe the most tricky one. There's also going to be a degree of inclination towards ill will. Most people in the world have at least a little bit of ill will, a little bit of harmfulness inside of them. And so that inclination of your mind, the way that your mind is already leading, yeah, that is kind of your habit. That's what I would call the habits in this world. And these habits, you will notice, are very strong. Yeah, they're very deeply embedded inside of us. And normally, we are just like we're like a freight train, yeah, following these habits, going along with them without actually making any changes. And so whatever we think about, whatever our habits is, it just tends to perpetuate itself again and again and again. And the only way we're going to get out of this is by learning to think differently. And this is what this is all about. Yeah, so we frequently think about sensuality. Well, then that's kind of where the mind goes. But gradually, as you learn to think in a different way, you learn to think with kindness instead of having ill will, then gradually the habit of the mind changes. It's like the direction of your freight train, the direction of your habits are moving in a different direction. Instead of going down 100 miles an hour in that direction with this very heavy freight train, it's changing in a different direction. And you can feel that you're becoming more kind as a person, becoming more gentle, yeah, gradually, moving around as you keep on reflecting on this again and again, until one day you have changed direction 180 degrees, and your habit is to be kind, to have metta and compassion for people in your life rather than to get angry. And suddenly, that is your habit. And when that is your habit, you're going down that new direction 100 miles an hour, yeah? And you can't really get angry anymore. And this is part of the beauty of this training. It is not as if we always have to deal with these defilements. The idea is that our mind changes, and it becomes easier after a while. Once you start to train, compassion, kindness becomes a habit of your mind. And this is kind of the beauty of this. We're not going to struggle till doomsday with these defilements. No, we're actually moving. We're becoming a different kind of person. And it kind of makes sense when you think about it, because if you look in the world, there are some people who are habitually very angry. There are other people who habitually have very little anger, right? And that just shows us the potential for the human mind. Those human minds are basically the same, but they have been developed in different directions in this life, in past lives, or whatever. And when we see that, we know that we too can develop our mind in either the bad direction or the good one. So this is the good news. And there comes a time when you just want to be kind all the time. Yeah, you don't want to do anything bad anymore, because you understand the underlying ideas that being angry, doing the wrong thing, you know deeply inside that this is hurtful, it is problematic, it destroys all the aspects of the path, and so you just don't do it anymore. And you are become a thoroughly kind-hearted, compassionate, and loving person. And that's beautiful to see people like that in the world. So please become that kind of person. Okay. So I'm going to stop there, because it's already 4 o'clock. Please carry on. There's going to be some more interviews over there. I'm going to be over there in a few minutes' time. And then we will carry on again this evening at 7 o'clock.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.